conglomeration of tribes, the Igbo language is the dominant and commercial language. So it is very difficult to forge unity among these people just one time. And what I would say is that, unlike in Cote d'Ivoire, where you have one national figure who was able to bring the country together, like Ukwe Gwande, in Nigeria, each of these regions has their own strong personality, and they are the ones that pull this region. And in Nigeria, there is no one, so to say, dominant ideology, say, socialism, or any other ideology that will bring everybody together. So the natural solution option is for a federal system to be evolved. From the beginning, there were three regions: the north, the west, and the east. From 1963, another region was created, which is the Midwest, around the between the western and eastern regions. So these four regions continue to exert influence on Nigerian politics, and particularly at the national level. In 1966, the political system collapsed for many reasons. First of all, the politicians could not agree among themselves. And of course, there was a huge complaint and cries of corruption. And we have the census crisis, and we have the election crisis, and so on. So the military dropped. Now, unfortunately, the military that came in 1966 was dominated by one group, one faction, and that they tried to impose, to erase federalism and impose unitary system, and to have state in Cote d'Ivoire. Now, that generated a lot of strife, and many people resented it, so it led to another coup after 6 months. Now, the military regime that came after 6 months thought that one solution to the powerful region, the three or four powerful regions, is to break them into states. So they broke them into 12 states. And that also is an answer to some of the tribes in the region who are fighting for their own autonomy within the region. So 12 states were created, and for 9 years, Nigeria was run under 12 states, under a military regime. Of course, the military has their own way of life. They are hierarchical. Therefore, under a military regime, no matter how, you cannot operate a federal system perfectly. Because the head of state is there to give command. You don't allow local autonomy for the state. When a national decree is formulated for all the states in the West. Now, as the regime continues, corruption came in, and it promised to hand over to politicians, but it did not, so another coup came. Now, the military that came in 1976, for some time, promised to do a few things to address some of the national problems. First of all, to create more states, so that it will give those communities that were fighting for their own autonomy also their chance. And then it will create a constitution which is different from the British type of constitution that Nigeria inherited, which is now going to be an American system, because we found out that Nigeria needs someone that everybody will elect as president. Not a prime minister that will be elected by just a constituency. For example, in Abuja, we have a constituency, and once the prime minister is elected, he goes into the parliament and is a member of the majority party, so he becomes prime minister. He's not elected by the whole of Nigeria. So they thought that one way of bringing unity in the country is to have the president of the country elected by a majority of Nigerians. That's why they made a rule that for one to be elected as president in Nigeria, you have to have 25%. You have to have a majority of what is 25% of the sales in the country. So not just the north, but you have to have what in the south, you have to have what in the west, and so on. Then people will not say, we have elected our president. Again, he created more states and then handed over to an elected president. But one problem that continues to be the deal in Nigeria, and I think it is also a problem to all African countries, but maybe particularly more about Nigeria, is the question of ethnicity and corruption. So much so that once you have an elected government, corruption sets in, and then other people from other sections of the country, they will start to agitate and complain over such corruption. Not necessarily because there is corruption, since there are all elites also are involved in the corruption. But it is a form of putting pressure on the government that does not come from their own area. So such agitation continues, and then the Muslim military comes in. In fact, there are certain people who are making studies now as to why it is that after 10 years of democracy, still with corruption in Nigeria, there is no really improved. But many people thought that after the 2003 election, there might be a coup in Nigeria. Others thought that after the 2007 election, there might be a coup in Nigeria. So it's a political scientist want to now find explanations as why, despite the fact that there is corruption, there is ethnicity, yet there is no coup in Nigeria. So, four things tend to engage Nigerian politicians so far. One, creation of more states and local governments. Two, revenue allocation. Three, power sharing. And four, which is the Sharia issue, if you like. And I assume we do something on that. Now, these have not yet been created. What we are asking is, to what extent can you continue to create more states? Nigeria now has 36 states. From 3, you now have 36. Now, more people are asking for more states to be created. There are local governments which are history, which are also autonomous. More people want to have more of such history and local governments. So to what extent can you continue to create more of such states and more of such local governments in order to satisfy the education of the people? For those who study political economy, they think that elites usually agitate for what states to be created because it is a source of revenue for them. If I create a state here in Abuja, for example, I will get the national revenue. And as a governor, or as a commissioner, or as part of the elite, I know I am getting an important appointment, I'm getting some share of the revenue. Others believe that, no, there is still education for autonomy by some people, because they are still dominated, particularly in some areas of Nigeria. So you need to address that question of domination. But as a whole, I believe that you do not need to create more states. But the issue of more states now weakens the federal system. Because the federal system is supposed to have some strong, viable state origin that can stand on their own, even without the revenue coming from the oil. Now, if more states are created, more local governments are created, they are becoming dependent on the federal government, which means the question of federal limits is no longer there. This is one. Number two, when it comes to the question of revenue, in colonial and even just the post-colonial Nigeria,
that did not depend on agriculture. And the bulk of the region collected their revenue from such agricultural produce. Today, Nigeria is dependent 80% on oil. Even if this oil will remain forever, there are crises as to how do we share this revenue coming from oil. Do we look at the areas from where oil is coming and give them another share? Or do we share it equally? Or do we look at population and then give more to population? And so on. So to address this situation, many of the Nigerian politicians devise a method of revenue allocation in which they allocate certain percentage to those areas where oil comes from. They allocate certain percentage to population. They allocate certain percentage to even land environmental problems. And with that, they hope it will solve the problem of revenue allocation. But it has not. Because you have the Niger Delta crisis. The Niger Delta crisis is becoming a very big issue, in fact, the biggest issue in Nigeria today. And many people believe that if you do not address it, in real form, then likely to create some discomfort within the federal government. Because maybe some of the Niger Delta areas could attempt to break out from Nigeria. Now, that would also result in, might result in another civil war, because the same area wanted to break away in 1966 and a civil war ensued. So this has to be addressed also. Then you now have the question of power sharing. Since most people still believe that you don't see a Nigerian and say, yes, I'm a Nigerian. Maybe when you go outside the country, he considers himself a Nigerian. But within Nigeria, most people consider themselves as Yoruba, as Hausa, as Igbo, and the rest of them. They hardly identify themselves with the national cause. That's why they say the national question has not yet been solved in Nigeria. So, how do you now address the question of election? By chance, the northern area has more population. Now, if you say election is going to be democratic and it's going to be by majority of votes, then probably somebody from the north or from the northwest will continue to be Nigerian leader. So, they devise a method in which they rotate. They now say, okay, this time around, somebody from the north will come. Some of the parties, that is what some of the parties have devised. And the next time, another party from the south, maybe a Christian, and this time around, a Muslim. All in a way to address the federal federation problem and to keep the country together. Because politicians have their own way of dividing the society, there will be no war. Because if you insist on your own way, then there is likely to be a crisis or a war. So that is how they tend to solve the problem. Then, of course, the question of Sharia. The question of Sharia has always been there. He is likely to talk to you on those issues. Of course, the colonial masters, when they came, they decided to reduce the impact of the Sharia in many ways. And up to the time Nigeria became independent, it went on like that. But with a new democratic system, and what you may call a real federal system that Nigerians want to create, some decided that, look, since the ordinary parties does not know anything and does not agree with any other law except the Sharia, then give him that Sharia in his own state or in his own local government. Now this created a lot of problems. So another method that they devised is that, okay, the Sharia will be implemented or will be enforced only on the Muslims in that area. Of course, there are areas where the Sharia, Bashir is here to be giving further explanation. There are other areas where the Sharia would go in, but the law sometimes has exempted non-Muslims from the effect of the Sharia if you like. Now, one question comes to you. Since the South, particularly those with oil, the oil producing areas, are agitating for what they call fiscal federalism. When you say fiscal federalism, you are talking about the fact that if you produce oil here, then the revenue should go to you. Only the what they call the royalty should go to the federal government. That is, so anything you produce in your origin should go to you. Fiscal federalism. Now others say, okay, if that is the case, let us also, since we are talking of true federalism, that some of the states that are predominantly Muslim, they should be allowed to have the Sharia in complete form. Since this is a federation, we now have your revenue, then we have our own legal system. Now this is what the politicians are still, talking to God. And perhaps, as they usually do, we are likely to have a solution out of this. This is a short solution. Thank you.
Before having some questions from our students, we'll let go. Okay, Bashir. Yeah. I was saying, before having some questions from you, we'll let Dr. Bashir do a presentation about Sharia implementation in some countries, some states of Nigeria. Yeah. And after, we'll collect questions and we try to reply to the question. Thank you for being here. Okay,
thank you. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful, I we praise Him, we give thanks to Him, and we say prayers on the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. I'm very happy and I'm thankful to Allah for giving me the chance to be with you. You came from Cote d'Ivoire, and I really find it a very good opportunity to present the perspective of Sharia implementation from a Muslim point of view, from the point of view of those who are implementing the Sharia and who believe in it. So it's not going to be an outsider view of it, but I'm going to present to you what we as Muslims who are engaged in the implementation of the Sharia, how we conceive of it and how we see it, so that at least you will know from first hand what is the impression of those who had been agitating for the implementation of the Sharia, and what is their main idea behind it and what they believe about it. I came from Kano. I drove when Malam Bello informed me. The chairman of the Kano State Sharia Commission was supposed to be there, but he engaged in another function. So I came to represent the Kano State Sharia Commission, which is the main body concerned with supervision over the Sharia implementation project in Kano State. Kano State is one of the most populous states in Nigeria with a population of over 10 million. So it really represents Sharia implementation in Nigeria to a very large extent because of its population and also because of the earliness, the early period that the project started in that state. We Muslims regard the Sharia as a divine law. Just like the Mosaic Code, the code revealed in the Old Testament to the Prophet Moses. Just as that was regarded by the historians of the early Israel age, the age of the development of civilization, as the first divine law that was revealed to mankind, and the first to create what some called democratic theocracy. Some people called it a democracy, like the Jewish philosopher Philo. He called the Mosaic Code as the first true democracy. Why he termed it as that is that the divine law, it made everybody equal before the law. So it was the first representation of the rule of law. It was regarded as the first representation of the rule of law, where sovereignty does not belong to the hands of the people, but it belongs is a prerogative of God. He is the one who legislates, and everyone, both the ruler and the ruled, he is subject to that law. So that was in early history, during the time of the development of civilizations, after the Sumerian civilization, the Akkadian civilization, and so on. When the Jews came, when the Jews received the divine law, they formed the first first society that was governed by the rule of law, where everybody was equal before the law. So the Sharia is also just like that, because we regard it as a continuation of the message of all the prophets, and it is a revealed law. Legislation belongs to God alone, and everybody is equal before the law, and everybody is subject to it, both the ruler and the ruled, and it is not gender biased, nor is it bourgeoisie biased. You cannot describe it by any such way. Even though some people now, especially the people agitating for some women groups, they tend to portray the Sharia as a patriarchal system dominated by men because of the predominance of male jurists during the history of Islam. But these jurists, all they are expressing are opinions, and these opinions are subject to be debated by a contrary opinion. And the jurists were not only male, there are also female jurists who had their contribution to the overall development of the law as it was. So this is our own Muslim view of the Sharia. They regard it as mandatory, as an injunction of God to rule according to the rules of the Sharia. Because the religion of Islam, when it came not just as an affair between man and God, but it came to regulate the society. So the Prophet of Islam, he was a prophet. He was a religious leader, he was a judge, he was a commander, he was a head of state. He entered into he sent envoys, he went into the, he made diplomatic agreements between himself and other nations. So this encompassing view of society is held to be the basic pattern of the Sharia. That was why they used to say, even at that time, people that came into contact with the early Muslims, they used to tell them that you Muslims, you have been taught everything by your prophet, right from the basis of how to go to the toilet to the basic to the higher affairs of state. And they used to answer in the positive. So this is how the Muslims regard the Sharia, as a total guidance of their way of life. It regulates your own personal relations, right from personal hygiene up to the affairs of state, up to international relations. So that is why when Islam came into Nigeria, Islam came into Nigeria through contact mostly with traders. It first came to the northeastern part of Nigeria, the Kanem Bornu, which was an old empire, which actually reached far northeast to the Libyan desert. Part of Libya, of present-day Libya, they were under that kingdom. That kingdom was a Muslim kingdom, and it was the earliest Muslim presence in the part that is now called Nigeria. The kings at that time, they were influenced by Islam to a great extent, and they started the implementation of the Sharia at that time. They had judges, they had courts, they had a legal system, and many aspects of what has been mentioned about the Sharia in the books of Sharia law, they had already been introduced in that part of the country. This was as early as the 11th century of the Common Era. That is around 1071, 1075 of the Common Era. The influence of the implementation of Sharia at that, in that part of the country, led to certain anthropologists to make a statement that you cannot find a Kanuri man. That is a man who is the Kanuris. They were the ones who is a tribal group in the northeastern part of Nigeria and parts of Niger and parts of Chad. They were the tribes that were predominantly under the Borno, the Kanem Borno kingdom. One anthropologist used to say that it is impossible to find an animist, a pagan, among the Kanuri. Why? Because of the influence of Islam and the implementation of the Sharia for a long period of time. You can see that it started for over about 10 centuries ago. Then there are the Hausa kingdoms, the remaining parts of the dominant states of the north, the Hausa kingdoms, which include Kano, Kaduna, the areas of present-day Sokoto, and so on. These areas too, they were along the caravan routes of trade. The trade used to be between the North Africa, the North African states, and the North African coast, with goods being brought from Europe, that is through Spain and Portugal, to the North African areas, and then they will be taken down to the forest areas across those caravan routes, across these cities of Kano, Kaduna, and most of the cities in present-day northern Nigeria. And then they were also on the route for the Hajj, the pilgrimage. The farther areas of Western Africa, Mauritania, Senegal, they accepted Islam, came into those areas earlier than the northern parts of Nigeria. So there were caravan routes of pilgrimage going through those cities right to Saudi Arabia, to Mecca. Now these caravan routes, they were mostly the influence. They were the means through which the people of this area accepted Islam. And then Islam was being accepted by the merchant class. Then gradually, it led to the kings and the rulers also accepting Islam. Now by the 15th century of the Common Era, the kings have actually started implementing the Sharia as a legal system, because records especially in the Kano Chronicle, records have testified to the type of offices that had been established in this part of the country, which attest to the fact that the Sharia was being implemented, and the traditional books of the Sharia, the traditional books of the Sharia, which up to now they form the basis of the codification of the Sharia legal system, they were already introduced around this time of the history of this part of the world. This influence of the Sharia with time it started dwindling because of a lot of nonchalant attitudes from some of the rulers, and the task of mixing pagan practices with Islamic practices, till a point came in the 19th century. There was the emergence of a charismatic figure, Sheikh Usman Danfodio, who is well known in the history of Nigeria. Whoever reads about Nigeria, especially northern Nigeria, he will come across this charismatic figure, because he led a social reform movement, and he created after his jihad, which was a struggle that he carried to snatch power from the pagan rulers and the corrupt Muslim rulers, who were actually overburdening the subject with a lot of taxation, oppression, and also corrupting the ways of the Islamic religion. This was the main thing that made him start speaking out, and he gathered followers, and the rulers didn't allow him, and then he had to take up arms to defend themselves when they were being attacked by the rulers at that time. And he was able to conquer almost all parts of northern Nigeria. 12 principal areas were the areas that he sent his flags and his disciples to establish the rule of the Sharia in parts of Nigeria, as far west as Sokoto, and as far south as the southwest of Nigeria, Ilorin, and as far east as Adamawa on the border of Cameroon. Now, this system, it was more elaborate in the implementation of the Sharia, because Usman Danfodio was a scholar. Though he became a political leader, but he was originally a scholar. Therefore, he put the society on a scholarly pattern of following the Sharia. And he created an elaborate system, and his influence was felt even during the time, even before colonialism. Because Clapperton, one of the British travelers who were going around this part of the world, he came twice in Nigeria. He came first in 1824, then in 1825. He had a very wonderful comment to make about the situation in northern Nigeria. He said when he came, he had seen a society that was full of peace and security, and overall comparative development that could only be compared with certain cities of Europe. He said a woman at that point could travel with her casket of gold, of all her jewelry, from the end of the empire, from the end of the kingdom in the southwest of Nigeria to the farthest area in the northeast of Nigeria. She could travel alone without any threat to her life or to her property. And the rulers at that time, they were embodiment of example of good governance. They were not corrupt. One of the British historians who wrote about the situation at that time, he was commenting about the leader of the whole northern area, which was called the Sokoto Caliphate. The commander of the faithful at that time, who was the son of Sheikh Usman Danfodio, his name was Muhammad Bello. He said that this man, for him to remain for 20 years, he was the most powerful man in this vast land of kingdoms and states. He was the most powerful man for over 20 years, and despite that, he had not been corrupted. It is one of his greatest achievements. This was said by one of the historians who was writing about the empire at that time, a British historian, Dr. Houston. He made this comment about that and many other rulers, to the extent that one of the British colonial officers who came, he was saying that before the situation of the northern part of Nigeria, before colonialism, was much more peaceful and had so much more security than what obtained later after the arrival of colonialism. Because the kings, they were they were embodiment of uprightness, good governance, and the eradication of corruption, and the institutionalization of the rule of law in the society, because the Sharia made everybody subject to its own dictates. So this was the situation before colonialism. With the coming of colonialism, things changed. And when the colonialists came, they maintained the administrative system that was there, because it was an elaborate system. That was why they introduced the rule of the system of indirect rule. They maintained the administrative apparatus of the northern area, of the northern states, with the kings there, with their courts and their officials and everything, because it was an elaborate system. So they maintained everything, but they gradually tried to eradicate the dominance of the Sharia in the affairs of state. As a legal system, they undertook certain reforms. First, they gave themselves the power to establish courts, and they undertook certain reforms as to the issue of procedure in the courts, and also the cases that could be heard by each court of law. And secondly, they eradicated capital punishment. Capital punishment is established in the Sharia just as it is in the Mosaic law, in the law of the Torah. There is capital punishment for the one who kills, and for armed robbery, for certain crimes that have been mentioned. Now what the colonialists did was a gradual eradication of the Sharia, which with the coming of independence it had almost reached its apex. Now, after the coming of independence, the premier of northern Nigeria, definitely there was a bargain that for independence to be given to Nigeria, the northern Nigeria, which was relatively backward economically from the south, must find ways to attract foreign investment. And they said that one of the basis of attracting foreign investment was to make a reform of the legal system. Therefore, they introduced a penal court to stand in place of the Sharia. The penal court was drafted by an English jurist, an English lawyer, and it was practiced in Pakistan, in parts of the Sudan, in parts of Egypt, and they saw, in Pakistan and in the Sudan, in the Indo-Pak subcontinent, and also in the Sudan, and they saw its effectiveness. So they felt that it could also fulfill the aspirations of the Muslims of northern Nigeria, so that there will be a codified legal system that they feel will not make the Sharia, will at least be a way of sidestepping the Sharia, and yet it will be like a sort of a hybrid that will make people believe that they are doing the Sharia. So this was done, but it did not satisfy the aspirations of the people, because they knew it was not the Sharia. It was strongly opposed, though silently, by the Muslim scholars at that time. Now, since after independence, with all the political changes that took place, which you heard from Mr. Bello, he has told the various political changes that took place in the political history of Nigeria, the agitation for the Sharia has been there in the minds of the Muslims. Why? Because it is an historical issue. It is long in the history of the Muslims of this country. And secondly, the failure of the state system in Nigeria, because people are seeing that since after independence, the economic development that had been promised has not been achieved. Political stability also is a problem. The issue of governance, we don't have good governance. So why should we continue imposing upon ourselves foreign systems? Why not generate something that is indigenous? Why not we The people of Nigeria, since we have agreed to our federation, we agree to the differences that we have in this country. Why not each people go ahead to create a system that will fulfill their aspirations and give them the type of governance that will guarantee for them a life of advancement and happiness and security. It is the belief of every Muslim that the Sharia, being a God-given system, it is the system that will guarantee for the Muslim a fulfillment of his purpose in this life. Because we've seen through history that this law, this religion has created a civilization that extended, that covered the whole of North and East, the whole of North Africa, great parts of East Africa, the whole of Anatolia, the whole of the old area of civilization, the Middle East. It went into Europe, right into the up to the Soviet Kingdom, the Indo-Pacific subcontinent, Southeast Asia. So, because of its potency, so we believe that since it has this potency, it will definitely create for us an advancement in our pattern of life. Therefore, the agitation for Sharia continued. Right, any time for the first time when a constitution was being written, during the draft constitution of 1973 and 1979, when it was the American presidential system was adopted, there was a strong agitation for Sharia at that time. At that time, students in the universities, influenced by the awareness that was being generated through so much literature in English, they strongly agitated for the inclusion of Sharia in the constitution of the country. Now, with the coming of the 1999 constitution and the return to democracy after over a decade and a half of military rule, the constitution had given, had separated the powers of the federal legislature and the state legislature in a list that they made. That is the exclusive list, which is for federal legislation, and then there is the concurrent list. Aspects of the concurrent list has made it possible for states to enact laws that they see will regulate their own pattern of life in the borders of the state. This was what made the Zamfara state governor at that time to say that because of this constitutional provision, he was going to make the Sharia the legal system of the state. The issue, the problem of the Sharia as a whole is that you can't say you are going to make the Sharia as the legal system if it's not codified. And the issue of codification is a very easy thing. Most of the books of Sharia, most of the books of jurisprudence in Islam, you can make use of them to codify the tenets of law in a very easy pattern. And this was made, and the implementation started. Now, at that time, there was so much agitation because whenever the Sharia is mentioned, all that people think about are the punishments that are accompanied with the Sharia criminal system. The cutting off of the hands, of the feet, the stoning to death of adulterers, and all these punishments, they are the things that usually people talk about. Not knowing that the Sharia, as I mentioned in the beginning, the way the Muslims see the Sharia, it starts from personal hygiene to affairs of state. So when the implementation of the Sharia started being done, people started seeing that it was not as they thought. People thought that you are going to have people working with their hands chopped off, and the stoning to death, and many aspects of the criminal aspect of the punishments that have been mentioned in the Sharia, they think that that is the whole element of Sharia implementation. But the implementation of the Sharia is centered around a number of points which I would like to mention here. One of the most important is the issue of the eradication of social vices. The eradication of social vices like prostitution and the spread of alcohol consumption and bars and so on, which have traditionally been the banes of crime. When this was done in each state, it became like the outward aspect of the implementation of Sharia. So that in the beginning of the implementation of the Sharia, these states they had, they experienced a migration, an immigration of criminals out of the state to other neighboring states, to the extent that some of the papers were reporting that some states that were not implementing the